Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to InfoScope Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Rebecca Nolan, author of Deadly Time, a book that will chill readers to the bone. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Rebecca. Rebecca Nolan was born in Houston, Texas. She grew up running around her neighborhood unsupervised, exploring fields, and wrangling horses to ride bareback without permission. Her large extended family often gathered for meals where someone would end up telling stories, usually tall tales involving whoever didn't show up for the meal or about grandpa's giant fish that got away. Her mother's bedtime stories were often about her Highlands grandmother, how she grew up with servants to brush her hair. To a small child, these were stories of castles and kings and engendered in Nolan a serious love affair with all things British. She graduated from Pearland High School and then began a great adventure in Chicago, where she sadly lost touch with school friends. After time, she returned to Houston to attend the University of Houston, but got bored and enrolled at an art school instead. After a short stint of work in the advertising world, she got married, had children, and worked as a teaching assistant in Fort Bend ISD for 12 years. Rebecca joined SCBWI, HWG, MWA, and a few other great writing organizations, and now lives to tell tall tales. For more information on Rebecca and her book, visit her website at www.rebeccanolan.com, and that is R-E-B as in boy, E-C-C-A-N-O-L-E-N.com. Hi, Rebecca. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for being with us today. Your book made our reviewer, Sherry, just talk about it over and over and over again.
Excellent.
Because she said it really chilled her to the bones.
So good.
I'm really excited to have you on this show. I love suspenses and mysteries, and I'm pretty sure that your book is already on my night table because all the ones that I get good reviews, I just put them in there to get to them.
Excellent.
I want to, before we start, I really want to have listeners to know a little bit more about you. So what can you tell us about yourself?
Well, I am a native Houstonian, and I thought that I was a cat person all of my life until I got a dog by accident, and now I believe I'm a dog person. So, let's see. I'm short. I am not too overweight. I love donuts. And let's see. What else do you need to know?
This is actually by far the best background that I've gotten from an author ever.
I wonder,
what do you think about, you know, cat versus dogs now that you're a dog owner?
Well, actually, I do have a cat, and she's very sweet. We found her. She was a left behind at a house that my husband and I were renovating. She was left behind by the previous owners, and we thought we can't let that cat starve, and so we had to capture her because she was a bit wild. And now she's still a little wild, but she does let us pet her, and she's funny about stuff like that. But she, on her terms, you know, mm-hmm. she's fine. She loves to be petted on her terms. The dog, however, is very much in your face. Please love me. I love you. Please love me. And I don't know. He's just so endearing. Even though he's 80 pounds and he's what some people might term a muscle dog, mm-hmm. he is also a pound puppy. But he's just so lovable. In fact, the people that groom him occasionally because he does need to be groomed occasionally because he loves to roll in dead things. They call him a marshmallow because on the outside he looks really, really tough and scary, but he's really not. He's just a sweetie. So I love, it's you know, before I had children, other people's children were cute from a distance, you know.
Yeah.
And then when I had children, oh my goodness, I was just all melted, and those were the best things. And I guess that's the way it is with dogs, you know. You get a dog and it's just like, oh, the best thing in the world. It's one of the family. And but before that, before I had dogs, it was like other people's dogs were cute from a distance. And now I'm all over dogs. I love dogs.
That is so funny. I can relate to what you're saying because I was the opposite. I've always been a dog person, always had. I grew up with tons of dogs and never cats because I'm allergic to them. And then once we had a cat in California, I remember many years ago, and she's the only animal that I actually let on my bed. She would sleep up. Yeah, she would leave. She would sleep on, you know, right at my feet. And I miss that cat like you have no idea.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
you need
it was awesome. Yeah. So, but I'm allergic to them, and I put up with all my allergies for years because I was in love with this cat. But then I didn't have any more cats because my daughter was also allergic. She came out allergic to it too. And yeah, but I can relate when you discover a part of yourself that you're not.
I didn't know it was there.
Yeah, yeah. And this is how I see you also in your writing though, because I was reading your bio, and I realized that you have two kids that are like scientists. Kind of
well,
thing.
I do. I have my daughter is a microbiologist with Dr. Pepper Snapple, and my son is a he works with a company that makes parts for oil wells, and I'm just very proud of them. I just, you know, I could bust my buttons talking.
So
about
I'm wondering what they think about your writing, because your writing is you know, it's not what they would expect their mom to write, maybe.
You think?
So I'm wondering what, you know, this side of you that they all of a sudden are discovering, what's going on there?
Well, they're funny about it too. They're kind of a little bit not intimidated, but a little bit like they don't want to tell people that their mother has written this book because it is scary and it's just not the normal nice, sweet book. And but my daughter has told me on many occasions how proud she is of me. She was reading my children's book, The Dry. It's a fantasy for middle grade type age group, and she's reading it right now. And she said, "Mom," she texted me, and she said, "Mom, I just want you to know I am so proud of you." And I mean, I'm reading this text and I'm driving sort of, well, I shouldn't say that on the air. I was reading this text and I started crying because it was, I mean, just, it was out of the blue and I was just so, I don't know, you know, overcome. Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny because actually on your bio I saw that you used to show little guinea pigs. So I'm trying to imagine this, you know, cat, dog, loving person of guinea pigs all of a sudden deciding to write thrillers like the one that you write. So
yes,
like
I
Deadly
know.
Thyme. So and to our listeners, you know, her book Deadly Thyme will chill you to your bones. I suggest you check out her website at www.rebeccanolan.com, and that is rebeccanolen.com. How did you go about, I mean, first of all, let's go from the beginning. What inspired you to write?
Well, I've always written in my spare time. Even as a child, I would write things down. Because I had, from a child, I was early on, I had hearing problems. And I didn't even speak until I was 3 years old. And during, you know, that time, I became an observer, mm-hmm. and I observed. I had a funny family a large family here in Houston, and many adventures with all of my cousins. I had 13 cousins, and many adventures with them. We would oftentimes spend the entire summer with my grandparents down at their little fishing shack down at in the Galveston area, and we would catch our meals, and my grandmother grew her vegetables, and we didn't actually have to go to the store except for milk, and we would spend the entire summer down there, and it would be just fertile ground for so many things. I started loving scary things at that time because I started reading Sneaking, actually, Hitchcock magazine and Ellery Queen magazine, because those were not really approved by my grandmother, but they had scary stories in them, and I just would love reading them. And that's where it began, and I was probably 8 or 9 years old at that time, and I began reading Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and other, you know, big volumes of mysteries, and started reading them. And then there was a time period in my life where I was writing a lot and getting a lot of feedback from other people, teachers and professors, that I was good at it. But I was also getting feedback that my artwork was amazing. So I was and I was getting feedback from my parents that I really needed to become an artist. And I went to art school, and I graduated from art school, and I began a job as a commercial artist. But I found that I loved to draw. And so my drawing was very personal and very my notes, I would begin writing things about what I was doing. And then I became a master gardener, and I was writing for a master gardener newsletter and for a neighborhood newsletter about bugs. And I began just, I don't know, that was in my 20s. And then by the time I had my first child in my 30s, I was started my murder mystery writing. And I was writing a murder mystery set in Galveston. It's still in my folder. It's not out yet because it's pretty awful. But eventually, I'll probably use notes from that to create something. But yeah, I began writing when I was a child, and I still have to write. It's something. If I don't write, if I'm not writing, I can't sleep.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specialized in interviewing published authors about their current books and their areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast, as well as MP3 download from your computer for your convenience. Please visit us at InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Rebecca Nolan, author of Deadly Time. Stay tuned because we are going to continue this fun conversation with Rebecca about her inspiration to write thrillers, cats versus dogs, developing characters, and her country versus downtown Houston, self-publishing, and so much more. But in the meantime, you can check out her book, Deadly Time, by visiting her website at www.RebeccaNolan.com, and that is R-E-B as in boy, E-C-C-A-N-O-L-E-N.com. I can relate to that, and many authors that I talk to, I realized that the writing is no longer, you know, it's not a hobby, it's not a lifestyle, it's just a necessity.
Yes.
It's a need. You know, when you're truly a writer, you know, the jump, I guess, that many writers like that do is to write for publication, because I used to write also since I was a little girl, and I was very, very secretive of my writings.
I didn't want to share it at all.
Why?
And it wasn't until, you know, the I became older in the 1990s. I began writing for publication and sending articles and getting published, mostly with children's stories and stuff. So it came in a very late age after I had kids. And I wonder, how did that happen with you? Did you realize all of a sudden you wanted to publish your work and started making that commitment with yourself, or did somebody suggest it? How did that happen?
Well, I had an experience as a child when I was 16. I had something happened to me that my father said, "You must write this down. You must make this a book." And that was back in the 70s. And I actually did. I wrote it down, and I sent it off to get published to New York City. And that did not get published. They wrote me back a very nice rejection letter and said that my subject matter was too controversial. That was in 1973.
Wow.
I believe it probably still is controversial, mm-hmm. and that's the reason why it's now becoming my third book. It's not on the back burner. It's actually being created. I'm working on it right now.
Oh,
so
great.
In 1973, I still have that book that was rejected, but it's now become the outline for a new book that is not about me. It's about somebody else,
mm-hmm.
but I'm using my notes from my old book.
That's awesome.
And it's going to be there someday.
That's awesome. I need to ask this question because I'm dying to know. Did you design your own creepy cover for Deadly Time?
The creepy cover. Yes, actually, I have a wonderful book designer. Her name is Heidi Dory, and she lives in Midland. And Heidi, I had written to Heidi. She designed book covers for a friend of mine who is, and I love her book covers, and they're not creepy at all. They're gorgeous. And I wrote to Heidi, emailed her, and I said, "I have this book, and here's what it's about, and what do you think?" And so she sent me, I guess it took her about 6 months, mm-hmm. she sent me a list, goodness, about 7 or 8, I guess, mock-ups of book covers. And they were all dark, and usually there was a spider involved, mm-hmm. or a clock, and you know, they were all like black and maybe a little bit of color, a little red or something. And I was just, there was nothing that was really, you know, speaking to me. And then mm-hmm. this last cover, oh my goodness, it was green and there was purple and there was this doll and it was so creepy. And I said, that is it. That's perfect. And
it
so,
is perfect because it calls the attention. Even I think that if people see the cover of your book on the bookstore, they're going to be intrigued no matter whether they are regular mystery and thrillers readers or not. And it's just that type of cover that is a little disturbing, and it hooks you up a little. I don't know how to explain it, but every time I look at the cover, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm going to get to that book because unfortunately I have a lot of deadlines too when it comes to reading books.
Yeah.
And so I usually try to put in like a book that I want to read in between my reviews. And mm-hmm. and so when I'm swamped with, you know, deadlines, I have to put them in the back burner for a month or two. But that's the secret of a good cover, you know, that it keeps
yes.
nagging it in your brain.
Yeah.
And I love it. I think it's an excellent cover.
Well, and people think at first when they see it, they think that it's a horror story. It's not a horror story.
Mm-hmm.
It's very scary, but it's not a horror story. And they say, well, why is there a doll on the front? And I said, well, in certain areas of the world, when a child goes missing or a child is hurt or a child is killed, people leave memorials about, they leave teddy
oh,
bears,
true, yeah.
they leave dolls, they leave candles, flowers, and that's what that is about. It's about the child that is maybe gone, but then there's also the fact that the child, that doll doesn't look dead. That doll looks a little bit alive. So there's a little secret there.
Yeah. It's an awesome. I'm glad you explained it to me because now it's going to nag me more.
Good.
Now, one thing that I really know because of all the mentioning of your book with our reviewer, your characters are awesome. They are just totally awesome.
Thank you.
And you did a great job developing the characters and putting them together. They create this great suspenseful story for the reader. And I remember I went to a writer's conference, and there was this lady that writes detective stories that she had published, I don't know, like 6 or 7 books. And I'm talking in the 1994 time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember something that followed me is that she said, you know, when I write, I daydream. And since I'm daydreaming, my main character is always going to be me, and it's always going to be skinny and pretty. So I'm wondering how much of this main characters are an image of who you are or who you want to be.
Right. You know, that's a great question. I really like that question. Because I don't want to imply that I have a split personality, but I have part of me in quite a few of the characters. And then I also imagined people that were very close to me, my mother, my father, people that have been in my life as parts and pieces of them are in other of my characters. I love all my characters. My characters are, if you love a character, that character becomes much more vivid on the page. And Ruth, I imagine what happened with the very beginning of the seed of the story was a bad dream that I had. And, you know, as a mother, especially as a young mother, when your children are tiny, you have bad dreams about them. Some thing that happens to them or something, and you have to figure out in your dream how to protect them or how to save them.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this bad dream that my child was walking on the beach with her friend, and she found something that was pretty horrifying. And then what happened was in this bad dream was that the bad person in this bad dream was a very important figure of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just this, it was so scary because of that, because whenever you have a figure of authority that abuses their power, it's a scary thing. It makes for a good movie too, and a good story. And so I remembered that those parts of that dream, and I wrote it down, and I took it to my critique group, and it was about 7 or 8 pages. I took it to my critique group, and they said, "Oh no, this is not a short story. This is a novel. This is the beginning of a novel. You need to continue. You need to expand this and make this a novel," and that's where the novel came from. So, yes, it's changed quite a bit from that dream. And those characters that were not my child, I imagined Ruth was me as a mother who's lost her child.
Mm-hmm.
I imagined what would it feel like, how would I be, how horrifying and how devastating and how traumatic this would be, and what kind of person would I become, and how would I react.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I wrote that character. And then when I bring John in, of course, and I made Ruth a lot younger than me, and I made John this very desirable person that could be, you know, a very desirable situation, maybe a little bit of romance happening in the story, and it does. It's very non-essential to the story, but it is there, and because that's also part of me. I always imagine romance in my life. I've been married for 32 years, and sometimes imagining is a good thing when you've been married for a very long time. And I give my husband little hints. This is what you can do. You know, let's make this happen. And so
read chapter 3.
Exactly.
That is so funny.
So those characters are part of me. But I tell you, I'll give you a hint. When Ruth's mother comes on the scene and she starts talking, I am ashamed to say that is exactly how I was when I went to England.
That
I was
so funny.
So obnoxiously Texan. I never say howdy, but I was saying howdy all over the place when I was in England, and it was just, I'm just ashamed of it, but that's what happened.
But and to our listeners, you know, this bad dream became Deathly Times, and you can check it out in her website at www.RebeccaNolan.com, and that is RebeccaNolen.com. Rebecca, I also noticed, you can tell I did my homework on you because I know so much, but I also noticed on your bio, and the reason I'm asking is because when I moved to Texas in 2000, oh my gosh, I can't remember when it was, I think it was 2006, I told my husband, I will move there. We were coming from Florida near Miami. And I told him, I'll move there, but I want to live the Texan lifestyle. I want to farm with horses on a creek and all this stuff. And I want the open air, and I imagine having this land. And, of course, I live almost maybe two steps from downtown Austin. So so when I noticed that you actually did the opposite. You know, you did go from that open space to downtown. What cultural shock was that for you? Do you like it?
Well, at first I did not. My husband drug me kicking and screaming all the way from Sugar Land to downtown Houston. And because we lived on a creek, we had a quarter of an acre. We lived in a neighborhood, but we backed onto a creek where there was woods and there were hawks, and across the creek there was a farm with horses, and we could see the horses running
that was my dream. That was what I wanted.
Mm-hmm. It was just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of property, and my husband decided when he was retiring, he decided I want to live under the big city lights. And I was like, oh, I've already done that before in my life. I don't want to do it again. And he, of course, being my husband, I came with him, and we have lived here downtown almost right under the big buildings, pretty much. We're about a mile from the epicenter of Houston. And we, I was not happy for a long time because of the noise, because of the dust. But we live in this cute little old 100-year-old house with wraparound porches upstairs, downstairs, wraparound porches. And, of course, I'm having to wash them all the time because of the dust. But generally, when the weather is nice, what a wonderful place to sit. And we have wonderful neighbors. I love where I live now. We can walk down to about three different Mexican food restaurant. We live very close to the best Greek restaurant in Houston. There's just wonderful restaurants all around us and lots of great people. We get together, do neighborhood things. You couldn't ask for a better place to live, I think, now.
Yeah.
So, yes, now I love it.
And, you know, it became a reality check for me, too, because I realized, you know, while my girls were younger, that would have been awesome. To live in the open space, but then I realized just how lonely I would have felt now that they're off college. So, and, you know, now my husband and I can really just, you know, work and then just go out and go downtown and play. And it made the best decision that he made was one of them after he, you know, deciding to marry me. So I really wondered about that. We are coming to, running out of time, and there's a question that I've been dying to ask you, and I decided to leave it till the end. Rebecca, you know, many times we come to that point of crossing roads and where we make decisions that will change the outcome of what we had in mind. And in my mind right now, for many authors, is when they decide to go to the indie publishing side instead of the traditional publishing side. What can you tell a writer that's in that crossroads now that you made your decision and you got to your goal with your Deadly Time book?
Well, I did try to traditionally publish, not very hard. I did not work hard at that. I'm in several organizations in Houston, and every time, once a year, there would be an agent and or a couple of different editors from New York City who would be here, and I would always pitch to them, mm-hmm. and they always were interested. And then I would get the nice rejection later.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last time that this happened, I believe it was Janet Reed. I'm not sure. An agent who had read the entire book, had read Deadly Time,
mm-hmm.
and she was very impressed. She said, of all the books that I've read coming to Houston from the authors here in Houston, I loved yours the best. And but I have to say, I do not represent scary mm-hmm. things, and yours is very scary. In fact, there were parts I had to skip. And I was just like, okay. And she said, oh, you're gonna sell this. This is just so sellable. I mean, there's gonna be people coming to your door. And I said, oh, okay. Here and then I decided, you know, that may be true. But then even if it's picked up, it's going to be a year before it's out.
If you're lucky. Because
yes.
you never know what programming they have. You know,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And then, oh, goodness, so many pitfalls that happen along the way with the traditional publishing. And here it is. I'm not getting any younger. I am going to just go ahead and try this other route and see what happens. And I can tell you, I can assure your readers and your listeners that traditional publishing and indie publishing are beginning to change drastically. In the last year, as I've been working on this, I can say the indie publishing is changing because more and more people are coming to the conclusion that when they do decide to indie publish, they are going to use a good editor.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to find an editor for their book. They're going to find a great book designer for their cover. They're going to find professionals to make this look like a professionally done book. This is not going to be something that people put down after reading five pages because of the mistakes. They're going
mm-hmm.
to keep reading. And this is where it's becoming, indie authors are getting a better and better reputation because of that, because they're getting their books professionally polished, and they're looking good. Now, yes, there are still those out there who just with a flick of a button, with a punch of a dial, they're going to publish awful trash. And that brings all of us, that tarnishes all of us. But more and more of us are becoming more professional. We're using good editors. We're using good book designers. So, yes, I think that we're getting a better reputation, and I think it's becoming less indie publishing, whatever. But I'm actually finding more and more friends of mine who are traditionally published who are becoming more, they're turning toward indie publishing because of the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Because with indie publishing, you might take 6 months, maybe a year, to publish, to polish and get your book, all the kinks worked out of it, and make it look really nice and actually read really nice and everything. So there are those that are traditionally published who are now turning to publishing their own books. And
yeah.
it's kind of a changing industry. I think about the fact that when I first bought my Hyundai Sonata, mm-hmm. people looked at me funny and they said, how do you pronounce that? And now the Hyundai is a very, very huge contender with Honda and Toyota and all the other big, big names. They're becoming a very big contender, and that's how I feel what indie publishing is to traditionally published books. They're becoming a contender, and that's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, and you know, and I agree. I did it because of the time too. My book went out the indie route, even though after I published and I was the first time, I did have some issues with the editing, although I did pay the publisher that did my thing over $1,000 for my book to go to be edited in Philippines. So we're talking about the beginning of all this. So
yes.
I am a victim and a perpetrator on what the bad rap that
yes.
And
that does happen. And I can tell you, I had it published by or edited by two editors. One of them was a critique editor, and she was quite expensive. And I was really hesitant to use another editor, although everybody said, oh, you need to use another, you know, copy editor. And I was, like, very hesitant. And I went, this has been vetted by, you know, thousands of people.
Yeah.
And I put it out there anyways. And then my a friend of mine came to me, and she said, you know, She showed me the book, and she said, if I didn't know you, I would stop reading it right here because of the mistakes. And I said, oh, no. I took it down from Amazon, and I got it copy edited
mm-hmm.
because I was not going to allow it to have those mistakes in there. And I got it copy edited by a grammar Nazi. And if you know any grammar Nazis, that's what you've got. You've got
yeah.
to have them.
Yeah, you do. You need actually two types of editing done to your book, and you're right. First is the story, per se, and the character development, and because a lot of people don't realize just how many things can you overlook when you're writing and rewriting, and, you know. And so
exactly.
some fresh eyes need to look at that. But before it goes to the print,
right.
You have to have a copy editor check on the grammar and the spelling and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, and it was actually awesome because I realized through the first experience on my first edition, even though I you know it did really good, I took it out of the market. I canceled my contract with that publisher system at that time, and I redid the whole thing. I remember, all the things that I did wrong that I didn't know, and I corrected them. And it was awesome to be in control and learn the process, in my
yes.
opinion.
Yes.
And when right before it went out, I did go to a writer's conference, and one of the authors, agents, when I told her, you know, about the book, and I told her, you know, it was honorable mention in a big awards. She told me, send it to me, and that's when my fork came about. I'm like, do I want to do this? Do I want to send it, or do I just, I mean, I've done it already,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and so I decided to go the indie route. I never sent the manuscript to the agent, and I don't regret it. It's been awesome for me, so... I'm glad to hear that, you know, you did try both ways and that you really liked the indie's way as well, because I think that the market is more, the market is complete thanks to the indies,
right.
you know.
Right.
You can find just about anything that you want to read because of the indies out there nowadays. Before it was whatever the program said that we should read.
Right, right.
And so I'm a big fan of indie books.
and I'd like to add too. This is something that Dottie Enderle. She's a multi-published, traditionally published author of middle grade and YA books, and she's now self-publishing under a different name.
Mm-hmm.
And she said this, and I think it's quite astounding. But it is something to think about. When you traditionally publish, your book has a shelf life,
mm-hmm.
like milk. It does. It has a shelf life. After it's right in the front of the bookstore for a few months, that gets put back in the back very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And there it stays. If it stays, it may be even sent back as a remainder
mm-hmm.
and unbought and uncared for. And so with self-publishing, you have the opportunity to have your book out there forever and ever and ever.
Especially with the print-on-demand system. Yes.
There is no shelf life, and that's huge. That is a huge deal.
It is. Oh, well, this has been such a great conversation, Rebecca. I'm so happy that you came to our show.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, check out her book. She has another one in there that's, you said middle age also for the middle graders?
Middle grade. It's a dark fantasy about a boy who goes in search for his father, and he finds him in a world deep underground that is overrun by giant insects.
Well, and I saw the cover, and it's creepy too. So
it is.
So if you like creepy covers and really good reads, check out her website at www.RebeccaNolan.com, R-E-B as in boy, E-C-C-A-N-O-L-E-N.com. Rebecca, again, thank you so much for being here. I can't wait to see your next project coming out. And
thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You're welcome anytime. And listeners, thank you so much for being with us. And until next time.